You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome back to Dominant, the Soonest and Smith Years. I'm your host, Martin Ramsey. As always, I say as always, apologies I'll start this episode with for missing last week, all due to record and a very unexpected trip to A&E. I don't know if there are many expected trips to A&E right enough, but certainly mine was not planned, and I apologise for not being able to put out that show last week. We are back, though, and back with a bang with much to discuss, and I'm joined this week by Alan Bradley. How are you, Alan?
Hello, Martin. Yes, and pleased that you're back to normal. David and I last week were sitting with a full kit on, ready to roll, but as I say, we're glad that you're back on, and obviously looking forward to this one, pal, yeah.
Good to have you. And David Edgar's here, the boss. How are we?
Bittersweet this week, this one, this episode, when I looked at the games, and a strangely unmemorable cup final, especially given the trilogy that it made up. But then how many movies, part one and two, are tremendous and part three is largely forgotten. And this one, probably not for the opposition, but for us. But it was a strangely muted cup final, if my memory serves, which I'm sure we'll discuss.
We shall indeed. We left off last week on the 9th of September 1989 with Rangers bottom of the Scottish Premier Division after four games, picking up their first win, and that Morris Johnson goal being the difference against Aberdeen. We'll get into some of the league stuff and there are some more struggles ahead before a very high note in which to end, boys. But you mentioned a cup final in there, David, that did not quite match the three that had gone before it. But let's start with Europe, shall we? The first round of the European Cup, and a disappointment. Rangers didn't make it over the first hurdle. It was, in the defence, a high one, must be said. Rangers could have drawn Slema Wanderers of Malta, Ruch Kosov of Poland, Nats Pernafelagai Fram of Iceland. But no, again, it was West German opposition that Rangers got, and this time the biggest of them all, Bayern Munich.
Butcher! Oh, Johnston was held there! Penalty! He was held then, no question, by his marker, Erland Jonsson, number four. That's a foul, and Butcher's header makes it possible. But watch, as the ball comes in from Butcher, Mo Johnston is pulled around by Jonsson. That's a penalty. And for Glasgow Rangers, the chance they wanted to break open this tie. The man to try and take the lid off the can, Mark Walters. What an important moment for him and for the young goalkeeper. Real drama here at Ibrox now, with about 25 minutes gone. A lot depends on this. Goal! Walters for Rangers. They're delighted. Play towards Volfarth. Kergel. What a volley and what a goal! And Bayern have equalised straight away. There's Grahammer. McAnally. Tone. Oh, that's brilliantly done past Butcher, and Gary Stevens clattered him. And what's the referee given? A penalty. Olaf Tone goes down under challenge from Gary Stevens. Rangers protest. It's a penalty to Bayern Munich in the first minute of the second half. Watch Tone put the ball over Butcher's head. That's terrific stuff. But now watch Gary Stevens. I mean,
well,
That seems to me to be irresponsible defending. It may look a harsh decision, but inside the box in Europe, you've got to expect that sort of verdict. Penalty to Bayern. Now it's Chris Woods, who has to face Olaf Toe. 2-1 to the Germans. Olfarth and McAnally waiting on the far side. This is Kergel. Oof. Augenthaler. He loves these. Oh, yes, it's a special from Klaus Augenthaler. That's the man's trademark. And on the bench, they're delighted. And they're thrilled too. 3-1 to the Germans, and Augenthaler hits a goal, almost a carbon copy of the one he got against Hearts in Europe last season. If you put him in this sort of space, he's going to blast away at the target. They gave him the room, and look at this. It's right in the top corner. Woods is beaten to the wide, and Augenthaler scores a goal that will stand out among all those that have scored in Europe this week.
David, I think you were at this, I think we've spoken about it off-air before, over the past few years. A bright start. Rangers are ahead, could have been more. A mistake by Nisbet, cruelly and clinically punished. And then they eased into other gears when they needed to. A phenomenal third goal by Klaus Augenthaler. And right there and then, it's stone dead.
Yeah, look, I, as a kid, I had tremendous respect for West German football as it was at the time, because even in my short life, you had seen what the West German team was capable of, a very fine team full of top players. And so the name itself, even as a child, Bayern Munich, you know, and all that it conjures up to this day, you know, they are a trophy-winning machine, and you knew it was going to be difficult. And I think that with England out, it was probably, to me at that age, the toughest draw we could have had. And you can argue about other clubs, but it was the toughest league apart from Italy, which, you know, was the undisputed number one. But this would be, I think, number two at that time. And I think you can always tell by the reaction of the grown-ups near you. Do you think we'll win this? And you got a lot of equivocal answers rather than the, oh, aye, you know, the breezy confidence that normally an adult will pass on to a kid. And it was much more qualified than I thought. We did start terrifically well. And you thought, right, okay, that's fine. But the thing I most remember about this was a kind of sobering realisation, Martin, of just where we were in the food chain. And I think that that, along with the result the following year against Red Star, I think that maybe set the tone for my European expectations being a little low, and then the 90s sort of confirmed them. And we speak about this a lot for people of our generation, that we didn't really, the one thing we didn't get in our childhood was European success, bar a couple of great runs, which kind of leads to me maybe being the opposite of what I am domestically. When I have a fairly optimistic outlook most of the time, in Europe, I tend not to have it. The Augenthaler goal was an absolute peach, and he was a magnificent player. That sort of sweeper that Germany seemed to have a lot of that didn't often translate. Later on, there would be Sammer, and I remember Matthäus playing there for Bayern.
But the 3-5-2, David, was quite
very
West
innovative.
German.
Yes, it was.
And that obviously allowed for the sweeper. We'll probably touch on a little bit about the 1990 World Cup when we kind of come around to that in a couple of episodes. But this was their way of playing. Some sides in Serie A had adopted that as well, but it was very much a West German thing with the bombing wingbacks and exactly that. The libero, the sweeper who could come out of defence, bring the ball out of defence, ping things around, and obviously pop up with a goal like that. McCoys and Drinkel suspended, David, following that final, or the last West German entanglement that we had against Cologne the season before, which meant Johnson played up front with Mark Walters. Mark Walters is going to be used quite a lot, actually, over the next, for his remaining two seasons, as a makeshift central attacking
number
player.
Number 10, really,
but with Johnson already being something of a number 10 as well, it was quite a difficult combination to make work. As lively as Walters was, obviously sweeps away the penalty well, and did look bright, but it's not the most natural combination up there.
No, it's not, because you are spot on when you say that Mo Johnston was at his best when he played off someone. It wouldn't be as deep as what we would now envisage as a number 10. And back then, a kind of almost 4-4-1-1 wasn't uncommon. It was one of the kind of few tactical innovations at the time that you would see. But he would prefer to do a lot of his work in and around the box, whereas Walters wasn't going to go and goal hang. And a big part of the way teams played back then was, look how many had a poacher, a guy who would, because he would occupy defenders in the penalty box, and Rangers don't have that. And I remember quite vividly in this match, the amount of times there'd be some good interaction between Walters and Johnston, there's nobody in the box. Yeah. And that there's the flaw, because our midfield, this is not the era of midfielders. Yeah, where's Ali, basically? This is not the era of midfielders, running on and making late runs into the box. So I always think as well that because Britain tactically was always a few steps behind continental Europe at this point, they know how to play a 4-4-2. They've played 4-4-2s repeatedly. We're not coming up against 3-5-2s. So straight away, there's that shock of the new for us that isn't there for them. They know the tricks you need to do to accommodate the weaknesses in your system against a different system. We don't. Yeah. And I just remember also, this is probably the first game that I saw something that Europeans sides are still much better than us at, Martin. Rapid switches from flank to flank.
Yeah.
And it was the control that they had that enabled them to do that. We had more gusto in Britain. We had more of that up and at them. And certainly physically, we could run over the top of them at times. But what they were doing, the two wing-backs, and they were wing-backs, incidentally. They were specialist wing-backs. They weren't full-backs converted or forward players converted. They were actually, that's what they did. And they would switch the ball rapidly. And because it would be instantly controlled and then the pass away, we were being stretched all over the place. I think Rangers, just early in the season or not, just completely ran out of steam, because I think this was a team who just wore us down into submission by their good play. And then there's real quality will take advantage of any error. We see that. And then you do have at the time genuinely one of the best defensive players in Europe in Klaus Agenthaler, who was just fantastic that night. But as I say, it was very sobering, because I think I had an expectation that post Kiev we were sort of up there, we weren't up there, not by a long shot.
Alan, your memories of that night at Ibrox, because from what I read from the game, watching it back, recollections of my dad, elder family members who were there, was okay, huge ask, but so was Kiev. That's only 2 years ago. Great start. There's a lot of electricity around Ibrox that just gets pulled out. I mean, the plug gets pulled. That's my interpretation of watching that. And David mentions the word sobering there. That's kind of it. It's not going to be like that again. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it is. And I suppose on this show, as you know, me going back, I think David hit the nail on the head as well, even with Bayern Munich. Because again, if you think of me, 68 Cup, obviously they beat us. They actually knocked us out the first cup before we beat them in the semi-final, the Cup Winners' Cup. West Germany were, at that point in time, with the Dutch. Obviously, I grew up watching, your Beckenbauer. You talk about poachers, Gerd Müller and so on. Those teams. So I had that, obviously, the older mentality then, because you've seen this before, not even just with the Germans, but yeah, probably just like your dad said as well, you go to it, it's a big ask. Like even now, you're just hoping under the floodlights, the atmosphere at Ibrox, we get a bit of a break. Obviously, we get off to a good start. But in the back, Martin, forgetting about your heart, your head has always got, as David said, these teams tend to be far more organising ourselves, technically better. We give the ball away. It's not like Scottish football, you win it back. 9 times out of 10, it comes back either at a shot or a chance for the opposition.
But getting, how often did we get punished with that, Alan, throughout the 80s and 90s? That exact thing of cheaply giving the ball away, and then, as you say, it always led to something, be it a corner or an attempt on goal. We never, I think, in this entire show's history, Martin, I don't think we get it right very often. We get, as I say, that one great run. But because we were so used domestically to you give the ball away, you get it back. You could be loose, you could be scrappy. Yeah. You're unlikely to get punished. You move to that arena, and it was just, you know, because all right, it might not lead to a goal, but it'll lead to a shot, or it'll lead to a corner or a throw in a dangerous place. And it just happened to us all the time. And you know, at this juncture, it's not luck, it's technique. We just didn't have it.
And David, obviously for me, I mean, like 30, 40, I mean, probably my first European games, it would be early 70s going right through, but these teams used to come, and as you say, even if you dominated, but they were so much more clinical as well in terms of taking their chances, and the away goal stuff, which obviously now has changed, but that became a big factor too. I think the other thing too as well is, it wasn't even a case, David, of if we lose the ball round about our goals. Again, I mean, it could be up at the other end, couldn't it? And as you say, the amount of times they could just, and as you say, with these kind of, the fullbacks come wingers now, kind of bombing on, it was, but I mean, we did really well, atmosphere goes, but within minutes again, it's that old famous, like, nowadays we're like, keep it tight, and as you say, they get back in. I think they get the other one, didn't they, just after half-time, and then obviously the screamer as well, just, I mean, that just killed it, yeah.
So 3-1 down at Ibrox. Actually, Rangers play well in Munich. It's a 0-0 draw. We're never realistically going to trouble a team, by the way, who is only knocked out of this competition this year in semi-final extra time by arguably the greatest club side there's ever been. Arrigo Sacchi's AC Milan.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's how good this Bayern team was. And it's why I mentioned Sliema Wanderers and all that. Because this was the nature of the European Cup. This tie actually resonates in a couple of ways. Between the two legs, there's a board meeting at Ibrox, a quite despondent one because, you know, clearly we're heading out. There will be no run to the quarterfinals this time. And Murray's basically asking out loud, but really to Campbell Ogilvie, like, does it have to be like this? I mean, this is madness. You had a couple of years ago, Napoli playing Real Madrid in the first round, when a lot of this cannon fodder is kind of making its way forward and you're losing big giants. Does it have to be this way? Is there not surely some kind of system that we can at least guarantee 3 games at home? And therefore, you know, guaranteed revenue, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's where the ball started to roll in earnest towards the Champions League, because that's when Campbell Ogilvie started to draft that kind of group idea, ensuring that basically these bigger clubs were still in it after it got chilly in Northern Europe, and nothing would be the same ever again. We'll touch on this later, but yeah, that's the moment. That's the moment when Murray impressed on Ogilvie to go to UEFA, and you know, there was a club contact at Anderlecht who felt similar. And clearly Berlusconi a year before had started the talk of the Super League, which was never meant to be serious. It was to get the horses running, really, or the hares running, sorry, at UEFA, and get them to concede to something that looked a lot different from the European Cup. As romantic as it is, four rounds, you're in a final. It's an embryonic, it's archaic now. I mean, it's almost a different competition. It is a different competition.
Martin, I think the point I wanted to make, it's also be careful what you wish for, because I can see our thought process at that point in time, and yet now my biggest frustration now becomes there's these top five leagues, there's seedings. What do we have to, you know, you win the league
we'll touch on it. We will come back to this as we go on. What Campbell Ogilvie did not foresee was the television markets dominating the way that it's thinking. That's not how 1992-93 was or envisaged to be. They obviously would trial it in 91-92 before it was rebranded as the Champions League. So, but it is, Alan, it is be careful what you wish for. But here's another example of Rangers. I talk about modernization all the way through this story. Well, maybe halfway through this story for the first half. Pushing at the door and being at the forefront of change. Because in our head, in Murray's head, we're at this table, or, you know, we're further down the table, but you know, that's where we want to be. And let's make a way that kind of ensures that happened. But yeah, absolutely. You know what you're freeing yourself from. We never know what we're freeing ourselves for. We never know what those changes, that modernization actually ever leads to. We can never know. We know why we're doing it. We know the drivers of change. Another reason that this game, I think, is very significant in between the two legs. In fact, as soon as touchdown in Munich, he does an interview, which of course was to deflect from the criticism of another European failure. But he makes an observation that I think lingers over the season, but I think lingers over the rest of his time at Rangers and for this the entirety of this show. The way the game is played back home gives a severe handicap when it comes to having any chance of being successful at the very highest level. In other words, because of the physical demands domestically, the need to play with this non-stop pace and aggression, he felt that it was becoming too difficult to build a team that needs to do this every week. But on a Wednesday night, now and again, against a team that you've just mentioned, David, with the flexibility and the completely different way of playing, you're going to take on new instructions and you're going to be completely adept at taking those on. And we're going to have players, by the way, who can do the same thing, which of course is a bit of a fantasy. You need steel in there to be successful in Scotland. Rangers are everybody's cup final. And you have to win that battle before you can start playing some football. It's not the case against Bayern Munich. So switching that on like a light isn't realistic. Souness observes this in September. He has a chance, when we speak about it in the next show, to follow through with some of those observations and be brave. Because as we'll talk about in this show, this league is bunched. Rangers have a horrible start to the season, but are never too far away. Souness is able to make tactical experimentation and play about with things, have a different looking Rangers team, which this season definitely is. But I think, as we'll discuss as the two or three episodes go on, I think he bottles it, actually. But he sees a challenge here. Critics would say, David, well, it didn't matter to Dundee United 2 years ago. They got to a final. And this is just an excuse. With all due respect, Dundee United were not troubling trophy engravers for some time. They could go and do their own thing, really. Jim McLean was quite modern in some kind of
They played very good football.
Yeah. But he wasn't winning titles and he didn't have to win every week like you do at Rangers. It was a completely different thing altogether. And European football was changing, okay? So the 10 years before Heysel, European football is a British game or an English game. You get 12 winners of European competitions in the decade before Heysel that are English. We're in this kind of interregnum, as I've spoken about before, from Heysel. You get winners from Romania, Belgium, Sweden, Portugal, Soviet Union, before Serie A, and to a lesser extent, West German influence supersedes everything, and you're into a new era altogether. It's this period of time, and we're just coming to the end of it probably, where we're speaking just now, where you had to adapt, and you had to adapt then, because as we'd find out, it'd be too late.
Yeah, the issue, though, isn't a Scottish football issue, and that was how Souness framed it. It's a Rangers issue, because for the reasons you've just mentioned. Dundee United, for example, that amazing European run, knocking out Mönchengladbach and Barcelona on the way. They were kind of renowned, a little bit like Nottingham Forest were in this period, for being a very good side that brung through a lot of good young players, that played nice football, neat and tidy football, could beat Rangers or Celtic or Aberdeen or whoever on any given day and didn't win anything. And were never in the race to win the title. But they did play the right way. And you and I have discussed many times, Martin, for various clubs, that almost Wengerian thing of, but we play the right way. And it becomes a sort of shibboleth and it becomes a grail. And that was Dundee United. So yeah, they were able to switch to that. Hearts in 89, a much more physical side, though, were able to go on. But that's why change, which Souness was sort of hinting at that he would like to see the whole game, was never going to happen, because it was a Rangers problem that we're everyone's cup final. Everyone wants to beat us.
Yeah.
So that's why you can't you can't change, or there's no incentive whatsoever for other teams to change to help Rangers be better in Europe. And this was always why he was going to run into a wall with it. It's just your circumstances. You do have to deal with it. And I think you're right. I think that he could have pushed us into a different direction. I think Rangers certainly had the funds to be able to do that, and to be able to sign European specialists. I always remember the Aberdeen team of 83. Alan will remember this, the one that won the Cup Winners' Cup. Doogie Bell couldn't get into that team domestically. Couldn't get near it. First name in the team sheet in Europe every time. Ferguson said it himself. Peter Weir was another one that would be used sparingly. Much more technique. First name on the second name behind Doogie Bell on the team sheet in European games. You did have to do horses for courses. And to me, it's more to Souness's. I think it is an excuse, Martin, if I'm being totally honest. It might be a valid reason, but I think he's putting it out
there. It's a valid observation. Rangers cannot build the team that we want to win titles. Well, before anyway, from the first 3 years, when you're trying to break through new ground and establish yourself as a dominant team, okay? I think there's probably an argument that have a bit more courage now on the ball and just, you know, you're better than these teams. And you've made the observation, both won't work. They won't. So we've got a bit of ground now, a bit of breathing space domestically. Now's the time to power through. The other issue, for all the money that we were able to spend, could have spent more if you know, Murray had leveraged things within the club and whatever else. What you would need then, because Best of British is pretty much over in terms of that signing policy. What you're looking for is where we get to Kuznetsov and genuine class European players. But we know that any new ones after 1988, we can only play four. And then in 1991, any of the ones that we have here, we can only play four, because some of them were any non-Scots that were on the books pre the summer of 1988 would have a 3 years grace.
Martin, there's also a factor to around the style of play and counter-attacking, which Rangers typically wouldn't be asked to do, you know, in most of our games. Dundee United, obviously they would. I mean, no competition. But you get, and Walter Smith, obviously, when Walter came back in the end, okay, Rangers then play that. But we seem to have this mindset. You hit the nail on the head, Martin, about we're at the table or we're certainly somewhere down the table. I think that's the thing that Rangers at the top didn't realise. When we're suddenly coming up against the, you know, the Bayern Munichs or St Etienne's or whoever it would be, we're really going to have to change our style. We can't just give it, we're Rangers. And I don't think they picked up on that at all. And I think what happened, we saw it all the time. I think you'll remember it as well. Both of you guys, we would go away from home. We'd maybe have, say, like McCoyster, kind of one guy, but we couldn't make it stick at all, you know. And now, even if you look at the current Rangers team now and the way we've done over the past few years, it's a different style. And I think we missed that trick a wee bit during that period.
What I find fascinating just about the time that we're on talking about tonight, he is experimenting because he knows, I think, that he has room. They're all going to cut each other up. No one's going to run away from us. And this is a more compact Rangers team, scores fewer goals but concedes a lot fewer. It's not as expansive. It's just quite technical and quite neat. And he's trying to do something, especially in that first half. But as we'll see in December, I think there's a moment there where he needs to push through with the correct observations.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. And he goes back to what he knows will work in Scotland, because this is the problem. We'll talk about the former rule in time, an illegal rule that I think hovers over absolutely everything. And we can talk about counter history and everything else. That cubs everything, really, by 1982, for sure. Anyway, another Souness issue was a couple of weeks after that European exit in October, he nearly left. In fact, he'd agreed to leave Rangers because David Murray had agreed one Saturday night to help Michael Knighton, who fans or listeners of our generation may remember doing keepy up on the Old Trafford pitch. He's going to buy out the club. He's coming up a wee bit short for the 10 million that he needed. he searched out David Murray, and they got an agreement in principle that he would get to his 10 million. Murray changed his mind the next morning. On the back of his mind was this dual ownership thing. Ken Bates had the stake in what, Chelsea and Thistle. Maxwell had been involved with County, Derby County, and then Oxford United. And the authorities were getting a bit twitchy on that. I don't think Murray really wanted to get into something like that. But the agreement was, and Souness was part of this agreement, was that Murray would assist with this buy-in, but on, you know, with various conditions, but one being that the Manchester United manager, who 2 weeks earlier had lost to Manchester City 5-1 and was struggling, would be sacked. Souness would go to Old Trafford. Walter Smith would be promoted at Ibrox. And Souness wouldn't, you know, he didn't think twice about it, despite all the assurances and the you mean just become a director, of course, you know, less than a year ago. Huge stake that we talked about. Absolutely massive for a manager to put £600,000 of his own money into a club at that time. So all of this, but I'll go to Old Trafford. And I always find it interesting with Souness, even now, for this Liverpool legend, and he'd been there for so long and won so much. When he came up to Rangers, you know, the Rangers have been possibly one of the biggest club in Britain, even maybe even bigger than Manchester United. It's a bizarre thing for a Liverpool legend to not even bring Liverpool into that equation. And Manchester United, who hadn't been winning much for a generation. But Murray bottled it or had second thoughts or whatever. But things were not looking good. They were fighting with Alan Montgomery, who was Murray's CEO. He wanting more involvement in the running of the football. Alan Montgomery had a bigger office than Souness. I wouldn't discount that as being something that preyed on his mind quite a bit. There was a dispute. Souness called the shots. Murray had to move his man into a media position within his growing empire. But you could get 9-2 against Kenny Dalglish coming as Rangers manager. 9-2 on. And Souness 3-1 moving upstairs, because we just felt loads of fights, of course, with authorities and blah blah blah, that things were coming to a head a wee bit early on that. David, it was a Scottish game that Souness was changing, but not at the pace he required. You've mentioned that there. The 1-1 draw on that day with Celtic in August, Premier Division saw 4 goals from Englishmen, 1 from a Pole, a Dutchman, an Irishman, a Yugoslav, and an Icelander. Other clubs were starting to take the lead, starting to venture out, starting to be a bit braver. But again, as I said, Souness knew that he could tinker as well. We left the football last week with that goal against Aberdeen, but Rangers would follow that with 2 draws against Dundee and Dunfermline before Johnson again would pop up with the only goal against Hearts. That was followed up by a defeat at Fir Park, a 1-0 defeat on the 3rd of October. Rangers were sixth place, but only 3 points behind Motherwell and Aberdeen, David. It's he just never seemed bothered, very uncharacteristically calm and serene. I'm pushing this way on, but Rangers would lose late in November at Pittodrie, the only defeat against a top 6 side, by the way. 1-0, Hans Heelhouse scored for Aberdeen, brilliant goal. Good but point. Soon as said immediately, I was delighted with my player's performance, but it was one of these occasions on which it was the opposition's night. You know, we were excellent at the ball, and soon as just kept repeating it, keep playing that way, we'll win. You know, we'll be champions. There's just a this is very different from the guy kicking TVs and whatever, because, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the 3rd of October, David, 8 games in. Rangers have won 2 of them. And it's pretty cool.
Oh, and it was murderous at the time. And you can imagine what the equivalent of Twitter would have been like back in those days if Rangers had been in this form. Again, something we've mentioned, I hate to bang on, so I won't labour the point, but there was, first of all, an understanding that there were other good teams in the league. So it wasn't quite as bad as it is now, where it's basically 2 teams and then 10 others. So there was an understanding that you had other sides. That didn't mean we should be dropping points to Dundee and Dunfermline, incidentally. But the other thing about it, Martin, was I think by this stage, Souness has learned that these teams have good players, but they don't have the squad to get through the season. And back in those days, being what it was, very macho culture, they won't use 26 players, they'll play guys who aren't fit. And through the winter, as would happen all through the nine arrow era, through the winter, they'll drop off, we'll come through, because we can change people out. And we'll be fresher at the key moments of the season, because we'll not have had guys who've been playing with a niggle for 3 months. And that was basically, I think, what he had learned by this point, that there was the space for him to go and do that. And I think that, I remember that game against Aberdeen, it was a brilliant goal. Hans Hjelhuis was a brilliant player. Can you imagine these days, folks, a Dutch international striker.
It was 850,000 quid or something they got him for, wasn't it?
And he was worth, from PSV Eindhoven, and he was worth it. He was one of the players, there's always a few, I think, in any era, but that you go, maybe we should buy him, you know, because, or why, that arrogance that Rangers have is, why is there a good player in Scotland who doesn't play for us? Especially back then, that was very true. But I think that he just felt, and he would prove to be correct, that because of the advantages in terms of squad depth that Rangers had, because of, I suppose, our knowledge at this stage, he knew that we would come through the sort of, ironically, actually, for a team that would probably suggest that played the better football, when the pitches got tough, when the legs started to ache, that's when we would really put our foot down.
I mean, I think that's great point. And we've did it for years, didn't we? It was suddenly when it came to that time of year. Another thing you said as well about the squads, I think, if I remember, Motherwell were pretty much near the top at the time. Obviously, they beat us, I think Bobby Russell scored, didn't they? But again, a lot of these teams were. But you just knew that come February time or beyond, things would level off. I don't know if you remember, but there didn't seem to be a panic. With us, it was we knew that Mo Johnson was in. Trevor Stephen, although he was sort of a playing wing, weren't sure if maybe he should have gone back. But there was Rangers were still kind of just trying to find things. I think even the way McCoist and Johnson, although they played together in Europe, but I felt as well, it wasn't the kind of big guy, wee guy. But there seemed to be a confidence now, and I think as Martin said, with the depth and the quality that we've got, as long as we do well against obviously you've got the Celtic and the kind of big guys, and as you say, people will drop points against Infernal.
This is it. Rangers are a more rounded team, more possession based. The target man's gone. Kevin Drinkle has been sold. He has been replaced ostensibly by David Dodds, but David Dodds is very much back up. You're looking at, you've got three Rangers players in double figures, by the way, by the end of the season for goals. McCoist, Johnson, 18, 17, respectively, and Walters, with the rest scoring four or fewer. So there's a big gap there. So it's very compact, and the Hunter's a width, big guy, which, you know, soon as started, that's how he started, you know, Colin West and you always looking for Hatley and Mark Falco and then Drinkle, popular. But he understood that go back to this European or the changing game thing. No one in Serie A is playing 4-4-2 with a target man, with a midfield of industry and nothing else. Maybe Genoa with Thomas Skouravi, but then he's still with the Czechoslovakia and Genoa, still had some very skillful and gifted players.
There's also a difference between a target man who is a big honest lump who wants to battle centre halves and Mickey a Mark Quinn. Hatley. Exactly. Mm-hmm. A great comparison. There's a difference between a Mickey Quinn and a Mark Hatley. Mark Hatley can do all the other things that a smaller man can do. He can do the link up, he can do the, he can run channels, he can do all the things you need him to do. So if a player like that becomes available, but I think he was moving away from the idea of, I need someone with this physical set first.
We saw it in the Scotland-France one, if you remember, Wee Johnson playing.
Exactly.
I've just got the wee guy with the socks now who runs into channels. It was frustrating at times, he could caught offside a bit, but again, it's the wee guy timing his run, he'll go way out to the right. Obviously McCoist did it to a certain extent, but and that's where I think, as I say, Trevor Stephen, we'll see the better of him as he moves back again, but that seemed to be the way we ended up, once we get into that groove, just holding the line, and playing into channels.
I don't think you can dismiss the impact of that Scotland World Cup qualification campaign. mm-hmm. with Johnson and McCoist being so effective.
Yeah.
With Scotland qualifying against France and Yugoslavia, or with Yugoslavia over France. So here's your Scottish team against, you know, respected continental opposition, and managing to do the biz. And there's no big lump in hope.
It's intelligence. It's playing the game intelligently now.
So right, okay, this can work. And he sees it. And Scotland, by the way, during this time, do qualify. They needed a point, and it took a while to get that point, but they got the 1-1 at home to Norway. Ali scoring the goal with a brilliant lob. So we've got this mixed form. The Skull Cup, part of the Skull Cup contract, don't know if anyone knew this, was that Rangers had to be in the final.
That's right.
And had to score lots of goals on the way. I think we scored 14 goals in four games to get to the final. Three, in their different ways, 86, 87 and 88, brilliant finals. Absolutely different. They did their own thing, but they were breathless, entertaining, high-octane finals, which Rangers win, of course.
Martin, this is my cup. 1970, yeah. 75, 77, 78, 81, 83, 84, 86, 87, 88, 90, 92, 93. As you say, David, this is like Rangers. This is our cup, isn't it?
This is our cup, yeah. I remember being almost offended at the end of this match because this is our cup, and you had come to take it for granted early in the season. Rangers, as you say, Martin, don't just get there, but get there like a train. Which wasn't reflective of the league.
In the league, yeah.
We're not scoring many goals. And yet we go into the cup and we belt it. And I think that, you know, this final, third in a row, we've had two epics. I mean, and the buzz for this was enormous as well, because I think there was a feeling, the first one, nobody expected to go the way it did. The second one, people were saying, well, it can't be as good as the one last year. And I think
the Aberdeen one,
Mm-hmm. You've argued that it was probably better. So I think people were expecting that this third part of the trilogy would match the other two. And it just didn't at all. And I think Rangers put in a really, really disappointing performance.
It was sleepy, David. And it, again, perhaps speaks to this kind of zen, that our feeling of zen that's encompassing the club, because Souness and Smith gave them time off before the final. Smith said, you know, they've been very busy, it's been a hectic time, we just want the boys to kind of get in themselves. And I think it's fair to say Rangers lack sharpness. Paul Mason scored two for Aberdeen either side of a Mark Walters penalty. Aberdeen were deserving.
Never a penalty, by the way.
Not a chance.
I think I can hold my hands up here as a Rangers fan after 33 years and say it's never up. Ali McCoy backs into Willie Miller in the box and then drops. And for a moment, and Ali has said he thought this as well, it looks as though Willie Miller is actually going to kill him. Mm-hmm. Because it was, he just backs in and then drops. And for the ref to give it was an absolute shocker. But it was the only way we were scoring that day. We were poor.
And it would flat. Flat's the word, and again, maybe there's that sharpness missing, which was a wee bit weird, because the league games up to then that Rangers had really performed in, Celtic at Parkhead, Hearts and Aberdeen at Ibrox, there was a victory over Dundee United as well, wasn't there, just before that final, a 1-1 draw away from home, which is still a good performance.
This sounds terrible, but the team that really wanted it the most won it. And imagine seeing that Rangers in the final. But to me, Aberdeen losing the previous two, it had that feeling as if they were like, we've got to. Rangers, we've kind of had a wee bit of time off. This would be nice. Yeah. It had that feeling about it, didn't it? Yeah.
I had a feeling that the Rangers team that day sort of waited for stuff to happen. And the Aberdeen team most certainly did not. They went for it. Mason was a good player, by the way, just for younger listeners. I know you might be surprised to hear me say Aberdeen not only had a good player, but they had more than one. But he was very elegant type, very clever on the ball, intelligent movement, and as he proved, he could finish. He knew where the goal was, as he proves this day. But the Rangers team that day was very there was a going through the motions aspect to it. And as you say, Alan, the most peculiar thing to me, Martin's mentioned, they had got up for bigger games. And I think there is an understanding. We don't agree with it. And we, you know, we shout at them when they do it, that football teams can sometimes get bored with the lesser challenges when they've got their eyes on bigger mm-hmm. things. They don't always go into a game with the focus, probably subconsciously, that we would hope that they would have. And I agree with Martin. Look at the performances. Look where they've come. Look who against. And then yet in this cup final, let's not forget, against, I think, the second best team in the country. I don't even think arguably. They just don't perform. As a collective, that's the thing. It's not one or two having an off day. It's kind of like everything was laboured. Everything was forced. And Aberdeen, I think, sensed it. And I think also the penalty kind of backfires a bit on us, because I think it really did stoke a sense of injustice in them, a very fair sense of injustice in all honesty. But Alan's right, Aberdeen that day there was one team carping the DM and it wasn't us. And you ask your players to come off any cup final saying, could I have done any more? 11 Rangers players that day should have been saying, yeah, I actually could have.
I mean, Snelders had a couple of really good saves and all that, but again, that was late on when we went, oh shit,
we might lose this,
yeah. But before then, even when we were missing chances, it was like, you know, that at home you go, we're going to regret this. The players are kind of half, you know, kind of running away, and you're thinking this is going to. But it was only when they went up, as you said, then suddenly I think Snelders had a couple of really good ones. Other wee guy that jumped out too was this Ian Jess. Was this the first time that he seemed to kind of appear in the? Yeah. The kind of stage,
It's hunger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to boil it down to mere mentality, as I often tend to do. But, you know, Alan, you rhymed off the number of League Cup wins.
I think I'd seen 14 of them, Martin, up to that point in time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. We'll talk a lot about sport and gravity on this show. What goes up has to come down, right? I mean, you simply aren't as hungry as when you've not won anything until you were, and then, you know, after you've won four or five. And Aberdeen were very close to winning in 88 and 87. They will have felt something to prove. They were just simply the team that needed it and demanded it more. And that's sport. That's life. But it was weird as a kid. My first, I've talked about before, first cup final I could ever remember Rangers being in was at the Skull Cup final 86, and we'd obviously won three in the spin, and they'd just been such captivating games. This one wasn't, and we hadn't won, and combined with the league situation, because kind of what's going on there, the league situation had improved a bit. We did beat Dundee United, by the way, just before that final, 2-1 at home, Johnson and McCoy's, and Johnson becoming the marginal difference, really. He scores in that game. He scores in a 2-0 game away to St Mirren. Him and McCoy score in all three of those games, the third one being an away trip, a home win over Hibs at the end of October. But it really is Johnson that's popping up with important goals, getting things started. Later in December, we grab that vital goal and that 1-1 draw at Tannadice to add to this tally of crucial point-winning strikes, not the third and a three, but making the difference. None, however, would come close in terms of importance than his goal at Ibrox on the 3rd of November.
Munro to Walters. There's Johnston. Stevens. Johnston. And he scored! A typical Mark Johnston goal. Only 2 minutes remaining. The Rangers players have gone way off the pitch. And Johnson took this up so coolly. He led it off. There was Gary Stevens. And it came to him. He picked it up there. And then, as he's done so often in his career, swept it away.
Right, gentlemen, we don't have another hour to luxuriate in this this goal in this game. A bit of context: Rangers had managed to climb into fourth place by this time. The morning of this game, Celtic were top of the league. Coming to Ibrox for the first game of the season. But again, you get this congestion, so many. I think there's a, 4 points separating Celtic at the top down to Hibs in seventh. So yeah. Now, Celtic had conceded 9 goals, David, in the previous 2 visits to Ibrox. And to be fair to McNeil, again, and maybe the sign of how things are changing, he understood that. Forget the mythical Cavalier nonsense. He came to blunt the champions and hoping to nick something if they could. He said, you know, there's always a place for passion in the modern game, but it must be controlled. And to be fair, that their caginess nearly paid off. Joe Miller, Tommy Coyne probably should have done better in the break, but Rangers were the better team overall and most deserving of the win as the match approached its end. The winner, the only goal in the game, so characteristic, so typical of Johnston, David. Instant ball control, less than 10 seconds. The touch is stone dead. He starts a move and he finishes it. His first touch over the main stand, but he instantly controls it. Greeted by jeers from both sides. There's a big boo, notably next to a camera, so microphone, so it probably is a Rangers fan. The second touch at the edge of the box stopped a poor Chris Morris clearance instantly, and then with 3 onrushing, desperate Celtic defenders coming out to close him down, he gave himself enough time to sweep the ball away into the bottom corner. Suddenly, David, there were no jeers.
It's funny, isn't it, that there are certain types of finishes in football that only one word can describe, and we all know it, and we'll say it. It's not a cliche because it's a truism. It's different. He swept that ball into the net. He didn't drill it. He didn't hammer it. No. He didn't even place it. He swept it into the net, and all that conveys. This was a bit of an odd one, I think, for both sides. I know he'd played that one at Parkhead, but I hadn't been at it, right? So I hadn't seen it. And it wasn't live on the TV or anything. So here's Mo Johnston, and you're still not quite used to him running about in a Rangers top, right? There's still a slightly alien quality to it. And then he is against Celtic, those two strips, and he's in ours. And their fans were, I think, slightly caught between we're going to abuse him and we're going to focus on the match as well. And at times they kind of got lost in between both. Celtic, that they are very, as you say, very cagey. That's a very word for it. Not that they're not trying to hit on the break. It's just that the first instinct for once in that era with Celtic is let's just keep the back door locked, right? If we can get forward, great, we'll go. But it's not the hell for leather. And it actually made for a slightly less fiery Old Firm game. Still an Old Firm match. But
it wasn't brutal.
No, it certainly wasn't, because they are playing much more with their heads than their hearts, which again wasn't typical of Celtic in this era at all. And they clearly had been drilled into doing certain things. You could see players making runs, and then, Alan, you'll remember this, they would almost stop as if, oh, I'm not to go there today. And you would see the Celtic players almost like they were on a lead. You know, they would get so far and then they would shuttle back into position. They were terrified of a heavy doing that day. When Johnston got that goal, because, you know, last minute, they do that. We don't do that, last minute winners, in Old Firm matches especially. And I remember in the car on the way up, I said to my dad, wouldn't it be great if Mo Johnston scored the winner the day? And he just laughed. He said, aye, it would. But then my cousin Alex from the back went, aye, for them probably. So he wasn't quite over it yet. But we, you know, when he gets the ball, and as you say, Martin, it's such an elegant piece of work. And then I don't think any Rangers fan incidentally could have faulted him that day for not trying if he hadn't got the goal. I don't think anyone could say, oh, it's Celtic, so he didn't turn up. But he puts it away, Bedlam. I mean, Bedlam. And if you're a wee boy in Old Firm Bedlam, you're getting hurtled into the air, right? Just accept it before it happens, right? So, of course, I'm flying through the air, but I still managed to see him go in that run. You know, what I thought was brilliant about this, never gets mentioned. He bends his run into the corner. I wonder if he thought he could be caught offside in his celebration. Yeah. Watch it, folks. He bends his run into the corner. Maybe it's just habit, you know. And
it was a bit like it was like Albert's meant to win the league at Parkhead, and Albert's going, "I'm running there," and he goes, "Oh shit, I'll run round that way." As you say, as if a bit of that kicked into his head, didn't it?
He kind of angles. He watch it. It goes in a sort of crescent shape, and you know he was delighted. And the joke, of course, is that they finally caught him at Cessna, but the place was just going absolutely barmy, and again you could sense the total and utter feeling of desolation in their end. It's an Old Firm win, an Old Firm loss for them. It's a last minute one. There's nothing more painful, but then it had to be him that got that goal. And they weren't angry the way that, you know, or they weren't disappointed even in the usual fashion. I can't think. It was just pure desolation. They didn't even have the energy or the spirit left to kind of abuse them after that. They just slunk.
It's the biggest fear, David. It must have been the biggest fear, for as much as, and even at Parkhead, and the first chance was unlucky, second chance, of course, he should have buried, and they would have delighted in that. But it's delight through relief, because in the back of your mind, you know how good this guy is. He's going to score eventually, and it's going to feel the worst football and pain imaginable. Alan, your memories of that day. I'm so interested in again those jeers and boos, whistles at the start of that move, and then of course no one really standing with their arms folded.
I'll keep it as quick as I can, but obviously when you were on with John and Andy before about it, when Mo Johnson signed for me, it was just the greatest thing. You know, there was people doubting. I just always thought it just put us in a whole new kind of level. You know, the quality of the player, but also all of the stuff that I grew up with in the 60s and 70s, but I just thought it was a great signing. I was at the Airdrie one, the friendlies, so I, from the get-go, I was 100% behind him. The Bayern Munich one we talked about, I forgot to mention. I remember he put his head in. It was Andy Gray style. I think he got kicked in the head. To me, he showed this guy, he's working his backside off. But putting my hand up, at that point in time, we had a good few chances in that game, Martin, and we hadn't put them away. And I remember turning around to David Best, and this is terrible, and saying, I'm not sure if he is actually going to score. And this was literally about 7 or 8 minutes before. But I certainly hadn't heard any of the booing, and it was delightful. And my mate, who was a postman with me way back, season ticket holder, going to see Celtic from the late 50s, I told the story that him and his pal, his son, were going to get season books at the time Mo Johnson was there. They get the photograph. I'm down the next weekend when he's meant to have signed. Look at the picture of wee Mo and young Robert. The family are all so chuffed. I was down a few weeks later, Martin. Obviously, that had gone. But my mate to this day, after that goal, never went back to Ibrox. And you've just said it killed them. That's what Robert said, and nothing even to do with going. The moment that I felt and I saw Johnson doing that, getting there, I just can never ever go back.
Tommy Burns had called Johnson a runt in the summer after that game. He said, typical of Mo, wasn't it? You give him one sight of goal and he sticks it away. But that has always been his strength, and I suppose that's why Rangers were prepared to spend £1.5 million to get him. The use of suppose gave that praise a certain grudging quality, but as I said, at least it's an improvement on a wee runt, and also maybe a subtle dig at the overall ambition of his club in comparison to their great rivals. It was a moment, a huge moment. Be careful of talking about a kind of momentous turning point in Scottish football, that, you know, these two clubs were not at some kind of existential crossroads at this stage of 1989. No. It was a final blow to this kind of staggering football club. A wee bit like the fall of the Berlin Wall, which would happen 6 days later, this kind of famous, symbolic, emotionally charged moment in history. But the real story was the undercurrent of pressure that made that specific moment so resonant. What I will say, though, Celtic were top of the league that morning, Rangers were top of the league that evening. Of the 24 remaining league games following this defeat, Celtic would win 5. They would lose nine, they would draw 10, and it would be 6 years before silverware returned to Parkhead. Always going to be a difficult period, cumbersome, bumbling, structural issues, board, not really in the same planet as the Rangers board in terms of ambition and drive and know-how. Don't tell me that this signing didn't matter, that the signing didn't create some kind of psychological sporting blow that hastened their demise, hastened their spiral. It should never be underplayed. And that's, of course, the moment where it happens, but clearly huge pressure beneath it. One final thing, gents, before we go. I mentioned that defeat to Tawdry, the Hans Heelhouse one. That's the 22nd of November, not Rangers off the top until just after Christmas. But again, soon as everybody, the bookies, the media, a lot of confidence that the title would be retained. 3 days after that Aberdeen defeat, Rangers hosted Dunfermline Athletic, a standard 3-0 win in the fog, but it was notable for the first goal, scored by Johnson with, again, an incredible first touch, but more for the pass by Ray Wilkins, which was sumptuous and precise. It was his final assist and his final match for Rangers. His contract was coming to an end and he had the chance to go back to play in London, a city that he loved. And Wilkins bid an emotional goodbye to our support, Alan, that loved him dearly. And this was, I think everyone understood, there's no recrimination. And he was only here for 2 years, but...
You're saying, I mean, he was emotional going off. We were like, geez, that's a wee man away. Obviously, there's the kind of goal, the one, you know, the goal we all talk about, but just such a brilliant player. I mean, obviously, I'd seen him even before he came to Rangers, so you knew the quality of him, but he just embraced us from the outset. And it just that calm head, and you're talking about class, and you had like your wee Gerrants and your Derek Fergusons and so on, but those laddies must have learned so much for Ray Wilkins.
Gerrant talked about coming into the Wilkins signed in the late November of 1987. Very quickly, like it was a shock. He was there. He was there on the Saturday. Wasn't he there on the Friday? He was there for the game against Hearts. Rangers won 3-2. Gerrant was struggling with a knock, and then he sees Ray Wilkins in the dressing room. He's like, Jesus, I can play. And he had a great game. But Gerrant and Derek Ferguson used to say they used to rattle balls at him in training, and he would just control them.
Did you hear him talking as well, Martin, the wee man? He said that first game, I remember the Hearts game, and he said my neck was sore. Because I was just looking at this, he's going, can they not actually put the ball on the ground? And obviously his influence changed a lot of that. Yeah.
Davey.
It was a weird day that day because I was a wee boy and I was, you know, quite stricken that he was leaving, and I didn't quite understand why anyone would ever want to leave Rangers. But you know, he was off the player coach role as well at QPR, and it wasn't as easy to get a, you know, nowadays big name players they'll get a go as a manager somewhere, but back then you there was a lot of people vying for a limited amount of roles because footballers quite often hadn't earned enough that they would be. Yeah. So it was either punditry, buy a pub, or continue in management. And he's, you know, he plays that exquisite ball over the top for Johnston, who great control, as you say, and a nice finish. But immediately Johnston just turns round and points, and the celebration's all about Ray Wilkins. So it was a real sad day because he was such a classy guy. And also, because of who he, you know, Ray Wilkins, 86 caps for England, or 87, I think, actually. Ray Wilkins had played Chelsea, Manchester United, AC Milan. He was a little bit of a status symbol coming to Rangers. You know, he was a guy that I think had delivered as well on the field. And again, he just played football in a slightly different way to everybody else that was massively influential, I think, on players around him.
I've got nothing to disagree with there. But the joke was, David, in the time that the main doors at Ibrox were changed to a revolving door because, you know, players were just coming in and out, very much this kind of mercenary culture, blah, blah, blah. He was only there for 2 years, but he is still regarded with so much affection from our generation. That classic, iconic goal and a very classy player, classy gentleman. Of course, he died tragically a few years ago. But even before then, with the amount of players that Souness brought in and quickly kind of turned over, you know, Wilkins is more loved than players who were here for 10 years.
Martin, there's a, if you remember, if you remember Walter, obviously when Walter passed, the way he carried himself, everyone that came into contact with him, there's a how you should act, you know, whether you've won, whether you've lost or whatever, how you deal with people, regardless of what level, that seemed to come across as well with Ray Wilkins. And it's that kind of, you know, the Rangers come values and this is the role model. This is, to me, he just, I don't know, he just seemed to fit into that one. And I think that's why, even with such a short period of time, the impact was, you know, immense, really.
Yeah, it really was. What a player. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure, as always. Missed this last week, but very good to get back on the horse. Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome. Really enjoyed it again. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, guys.
So Rangers climbing back, nearly back to the top of the league, and say goodbye to Ray Wilkins. And in doing so... it was a significant but vastly underrated moment in the evolution of this Rangers era of dominance. Souness could have replaced his ball-playing midfielder, playmaker, with another of the same mould, but he didn't. Rangers were immediately linked with John Collins of Hibs, who had been previously approached but turned down the advances due to the problems arising from the religion issue, and another player, Nigel Spackman of QPR, the club for whom, of course, Wilkins had just departed. Even if the issues that Collins had raised still persisted, there were other players of a similar style that Rangers could have pursued. But in the end, Souness replaced silk with steel. It would pay immediate dividends that season, the powerful presence that would push Rangers out of this dogfight and into clear blue water, and indeed for arguably the next 2 years. But it jarred with Souness's pronouncements about an incompatibility of style outside of Scotland. It was the right call in the name of expediency, but arguably would have consequences long beyond the season's title celebration. To discuss that and more, I'll be joined by Andy and John. Until then, bye for now.
Podcast Network.